Welcome into Buccaneers Insider Live, presented by Miller Lite. Casey Phillips and Scott Smith here. We have three segments coming up. The final one is getting to your Twitter questions. You can keep sending those in throughout the show. Use that hashtag BucksLive. For now, let's go ahead and dive into that Packers game a little bit. And just felt like such a weird way to lose. It was such an up and down game, and it just felt like the Bucks deserved to win it. And it just came down to a few plays at very inopportune times. Is that kind of the feeling that you had?
Well, everything except the part about deserve to win it. You make the two biggest plays of the game that, or you get them made against you that turned it. It's your fault. I mean, I do believe the Buccaneers would have won that game if not for those two plays that came within a few minutes of each other in the second quarter. And of course, we're talking about the play where Jameis tried to make a little too much happen when he was getting sacked, and it became a fumble that was caught in midair and returned 62 yards by a player from Northwestern, by the way. And then shortly, I think it was really before that, the punt block. It was technically a deflection and not a block because it landed beyond the line of scrimmage.
But yeah, it was a zero yardage punt for him? I was like, boy, that's going to kill your average.
It did kill his average. It did. Poor Brian Inger.
Yeah, I'm sure he's like, can we just count it as a block?
Well, the punt block that he had earlier in the year also affects his net average, and Brian's well down in the rankings in net average right now. But if you watched him this season, you could see he's punting just fine. Mm-hmm. He's just had some poor luck.
Yeah, that's very true.
But those two plays led to 14 points, and really that was all special teams and defense. And then after the block punt, you have to give Green Bay credit. They basically had two long runs, one by the quarterback, and that was it. And otherwise, our defense didn't allow them to do very much at all. And so we go into halftime losing 17-10. Probably should have been winning like 10-3. And then when we score in the second half, it allows us to pull slightly ahead of them. But had they not made those mistakes, and also had we taken better advantage of our red zone opportunities, which has become something of an issue in the last month, you're winning maybe, instead of pulling ahead 20-17 with 7 minutes left, you're winning maybe 24-10.
Right.
And so then Green Bay's comeback at the end is a moot point.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a great point.
I mean, if I told you before the game, hey, Casey, I can guarantee you we're going to have 395 yards, we're going to have like 100 and something more yards than they are, the turnovers will be even, we'll be 9 of 16 on third downs, we'll do well on third downs on defense, we'll run for our best rushing game of the season, Jameis Winston won't throw a pick and he'll throw two touchdown passes, you'd probably take that.
Absolutely, without question.
And it just didn't add up to a victory mainly because of those two big plays. And red zone has become an issue. In the last four games, the Buccaneers have 16 red zone trips and only six touchdowns. And that's something like 37.5%. And the goal of this team is 60%. So you can see how far off they are of the goal. And it's something, some little breakdown every time. The two obvious ones in this game were inside the five, the one where the snap came at the wrong time. That cost us a chance at a third down crack at the end zone, and we had to kick a field goal. And then the fumble when Peyton Barber slipped and Jameis still tried to get the ball and ended up being a fumble, did end up scoring a touchdown after one, so they overcame that miscue. But the one that I think people maybe didn't see enough as how important it was at the time, it doesn't show up on the stat sheet as a fumble or anything. At the end of the first half, driving down, we were losing 17-7, or is that right? 17-7, I think, trying to get a touchdown and make it close again. And first down from about the 19, we have this beautiful screen set up. We were killing it in the screen game all day. Receiver screens, running back screens. This one was perfect. Little pass out to Peyton Barber to the right. We have two offensive linemen pull perfectly to block one guy, Blake Martinez, their best tackler on defense. And we got two guys right on him. And somehow we don't get the block on him. And Peyton, I think, is supposed to cut underneath him, and they're supposed to block him out. But Blake Martinez got around him and made the tackle. It was a one-yard. I think looking at it unfolding, it looked like it was going to be a touchdown.
Right.
If not a touchdown, at least probably a first down at the five. Instead, it's second and nine, two incompletions, field goal. Lost
opportunities. Yep, absolutely. So looking at Jameis's return, that was the big story coming into it. How would you evaluate his ability to come back after missing weeks for the first time in his career? I think there's something to that as well, that he has never had to try this before.
Yeah.
So what did you think of the way he was able to come back?
Well, he looked physically fine, and I thought he played pretty well. I mean, we've already talked about the one mistake, and the one frustrating part about that mistake was you saw our guys slipping around all the game, right? There was a lot of guys losing their footing, and sometimes at critical moments, you know, like Ryan Smith fell down on that one wide open pass that Brett Hundley missed in the end zone. Otherwise, it looked like Ryan had a good game, but I digress. Jameis, before he started to scramble in that play, it looked to me like he was planting to get ready to throw down to the left, and his plant foot slipped. And so now he's lost it. His head goes down. He's lost wherever he's going to throw, and so he starts to scramble. That's when he gets caught and tries to make that play. Mm-hmm. But otherwise, I thought Jameis played quite well. I thought he was mostly accurate on his passes. He made good decisions. I mean, threw for 270 yards, two touchdowns and no picks. And it wasn't, correct me if I'm wrong, I don't remember, like, opportunities that he gave them for picks. Like, some games you end up with no picks, but you're like,
yeah,
I dropped that ball.
That's a very good point.
Like that.
Yeah. That's interesting.
I thought he played well.
And we had been a little worried knowing it wasn't the normal O-line going into it. So I think that may even speak higher to what Jameis did, that there were some moments that it seemed he had to scramble a little bit more than he's had to at other times in the season. But I also just wanted to hear your thoughts on how the O-line performed when not only did we already have the pieces we knew missing going ahead, but then Joe Hawley gets sick, and so it was even one more wrench thrown into it after, I'm sure, a whole week of preparing one line, and then you had to switch and
exactly
move a lot
right.
of things around.
Yeah, I'm not sure, unless you listen to Dirk either after the game or on Monday, you may not be aware of the adjustment that the team had to make at the last minute. You know, okay, so Damar Dotson and Ali Marpet go on IR. You know that at the beginning of the week, so you plan. Now, you plan for a couple contingencies. I saw them doing a couple different combinations out there during practice, but the main one they practiced all week was the one we expected, because generally when we've had an issue at right tackle, we've kicked Kevin Panfil out there, and that's what they were going to do. And Evan Smith was going to step in at guard, and Joe Hawley was going to play center. And I think those, at this point in their careers, those are the more natural positions for both of those guys. Evan used to start at center, but he's played a lot more at guard in recent years. Jameis said he hadn't taken a snap from him in over a year. So that's what it was going to be. And then Joe Hawley gets sick over the weekend, and you have to adjust again. Now Evan Smith goes to center, which he hasn't played for a long time. Caleb Benedict makes his first ever start at right tackle, and you leave Kevin Panfil at left guard. And Kevin Panfil is dealing with a little bit of an elbow injury, which isn't helping him. And so there were seven sacks in that game, and at least three of them, if I recall, were just guys running free right at Jameis, like never blocked, just set free. And that's – Coach said, I mean, to me, that sounds like a communication problem that you get from last-minute adjustments. Coach Cutter said it wasn't really communication. It was just one guy doing the wrong thing. Like, the play called for him to do A, and he did B. But still, that's still part of the same adjustment, I think. You know, maybe – I don't even know if it was any of those three guys, but if it was, say, Caleb Benedict at right tackle, hadn't practiced there for most of the week, and he was supposed to do A, and he did B, you can kind of understand why that happened. You're not happy about it, but you can understand what happened.
Yeah,
and
that's
true. That was just an example. I don't know that any of them specifically were Caleb Benedict.
Right. And knowing that moving forward, we're still going to be without Ali and Damar, and in theory, you could have Joe back because it was just an illness.
I would think so, yeah.
So do you see them going back to the original plan?
Yeah.
So knowing what we did get to see of that line without Ali and Damar this week, how do you feel about the line moving forward if it is able to go back to that original
idea? You got to like that it's kind of funny that the pass blocking, which had been a strength, the Buccaneers were like seventh in sacks per pass play going into that game. Very few games have our quarterbacks really been on the run the whole day, but they were in this one. Seven sacks, and Jameis also had to scramble several times. But then all of a sudden, the run blocking is good,
right,
which has been bad all year. And you got to give a lot of credit to Peyton Barber, because he was making a lot of yards after contact, breaking tackles. And Coach Cutter described the run blocking as good. Not perfect, but good. But even that's a step up. So I guess that's encouraging.
Yeah.
I would suspect if Joe Hawley's back, which you think he would be, that they would go back to what they practiced last week. Because obviously when they had all their options open to them, that was the one they thought was best.
Okay.
So I would suspect they would go back to that. You got to like a step forward in the run blocking, and you just hope another week of practicing gets the communications and the assignment down better. I mean, these are all guys who know what they're doing. That's we've been talking for 2 years now about how we have this very good and experienced offensive line depth, and now we need it, and they know what they're doing. They've played a lot.
That's true. And we only have a few seconds here. We'll continue this in the next segment. But how much do you think was the O-line and how much was Peyton Barber?
Probably about 50-50. I mean, Peyton, you know, he did the kind of thing we've been looking for all year, you know, making more out of your opportunities, you know, breaking tackles and bouncing off guys and turning 2-yard runs into 8-yard runs. So it was very encouraging for Peyton. I think even when and if Doug comes back, if it's this week or whatever, I still think you're going to see a lot of Peyton Barber.
Okay, we'll continue talking about that in the next segment. We still have plenty coming up here on Buccaneers Insider Live, including getting to your Twitter questions. So keep sending those in. Use that hashtag BucksLive. We'll take a short break here and be right back.
Give a cheer for the Buccaneers. Give a cheer for the Buccaneers.
Hey, hey, Tampa Bay, the Bucs know how to shine.
Hey, hey, Tampa Bay, the Bucs know how to shine. Give a cheer for the Buccaneers. Go Bucs! Give a cheer for the Buccaneers.
Stand up.
Give a cheer for the Buccaneers.
Go Bucs!
Because we know we're on the top.
We stand up.
Welcome back into Buccaneers Insider Live, presented by Miller Lite. Casey Phillips and Scott Smith here. We're continuing to talk about that Packers game a little bit. We'll get into the Lions game as well and take your questions, as always, in that final segment. Use the hashtag BucksLive so that we can find those on Twitter. We were talking a little bit about Peyton Barber before the break, and I think a lot of people were excited to see him, not just the run game in general, but also him have a breakout bit, especially without Doug Martin being available. We don't know Doug's availability this next week. So if he isn't able to go, I think a lot of people felt pretty good about what Peyton Barber was able to do. What have you seen from him since last year, this season, the back he seems like he could be for this team? Was last game a fluke? Was it signs of moving forward?
You know? I think he's been a guy that over the course of two seasons has become more comfortable in the system and has learned the system and has learned blocking assignments when he's in there for on a pass. Mm-hmm. And I think Coach was saying he just knows what he's doing more now. And he's probably more confident, more instinctive runner because of it. The thing you like about him is he was just running downhill. You know, he was getting some decent openings and he was hitting them quickly and then dragging guys with him for a few extra yards. So you get those 7 and 8 yard runs on first down. That helps your offense immensely. That's how we've really, in the last two games, we've had 52 first downs because we've been able to get good yardage on first down. And the problem is we're moving the ball great between the 25s and not so great in the red zone. But, we say it all the time. Every time you can run efficiently and throughout the game for 60 minutes, it opens up so much more that you can do, you know.
That's very true.
I mean, the screen passes and so on.
Yeah, that's huge. And, you know, Cam Brate, we had talked about how his targets had seemed to decline a little bit. Now, one thing that was interesting is on Coach's radio show on Friday, he talked about how people are so focused on targets, but that doesn't necessarily mean the play wasn't drawn up to him.
Right.
You know, that he might have been the original intended target. The defense does something different. He's covered. He's not targeted. And he said, so just because Cam hasn't been targeted as much doesn't mean we haven't meant to target him as much.
Yes.
Was this game sort of another indicator of how, no, the game plan with Cam Brate has not changed?
Yeah. I, if you ever want to get under Coach Cutter's skin and just use the word target.
Yeah.
There's a lot of ways that he doesn't like the word. Not only for the reason you said, but sometimes whoever's keeping the stats will say it's a target when it's thrown like 5 feet over his head. head just because he happens to be the closest guy.
Which doesn't mean he actually was the intended target.
Yeah, if you're throwing a screen pass, you've seen those plays where a screen pass is designed and the quarterback looks and sees, man, that's not going to work at all because the defense is all around him, but I got no time, so he just throws it at the feet of the running back. That's a smart play, but it's a target for that poor running back.
Right, which is funny.
So, yes, for both of those reasons, the target number can be very misleading. But I believed all throughout that drought, if you want to call it that, the Cam had three straight games with one catch, I guess, that it was just the ball. Coach will say this all the time, just the ball wasn't finding him. Because, yeah, you drop a play for him, Jameis looks, that's the first read, it's not there, he goes on to something else. But, again, I think part of the reason why – and, again, he still only had two catches in this game. It just happened to be both touchdowns.
Right. Pretty good efficiency right here.
The return of Jameis Winston is no coincidence to that, I believe. They just have some sort of red zone comfortability with each other. It's just, it's unmistakable. Mm-hmm. And the first touchdown wasn't actually red zone, but it was just outside the red zone.
Red zone-ish.
Yeah. So I think the return of Jameis Winston had a lot to do with that with Cam Bray. But in a broader sense, what you saw there from the offense, including the Cam Bray catches, was what we were – talking about before the season started, that the weapons that the team had amassed, the variety of it, the depth of it, and at all three skill positions, tight end, running back, receiver, was such that you didn't need one guy to carry you. Like last year, we really needed Mike Evans in the passing game, and really since the running game wasn't working, we needed Mike Evans to carry us most weeks, right? Cam Bray did a lot last year too, but this year there's so many options. So in this game, the Packers play, and I got this from Coach Cutter, I'm not that smart about coverage names and so on, but they were playing a lot of two-man, five-under zones and two-man man zones, which Coach Cutter says are designed to basically double your wide receivers. So the Packers decided we're not going to get beat by Mike Evans and DeSean Jackson. And sure enough, those guys only had four catches for a combined like 50 yards. Instead, what that gave you was the opportunity to throw screen passes to the running backs, the opportunity to use your slot receiver, and the opportunity to hit your tight ends over the middle. And all of that happened, all of it. All four of our tight ends caught at least a pass. The running backs were doing great with the screen plays. Adam Humphries was more involved in the passing game than DeSean or Mike because that's what they were giving you. Now, if you didn't have that depth and width of talent, you wouldn't have been able to. You'd be, oh, they're killing Mike Evans and DeSean Jackson. We're dead. We can't do anything. So it was a good example of it working the way that it had been envisioned before the season started.
That's a great point. That's a really great point. Even when certain guys aren't getting the ball as much, that doesn't mean they're not serving their purpose a lot of ways in the offense.
It doesn't matter if it's some guys probably care more than others about their numbers, and that's understandable in human nature, but it doesn't really matter if Mike and DeSean have the catches or everybody else has the catches as long as we're moving the ball. So 395 yards, two touchdowns, great running game, efficient passing game. It all worked, other than, as I've probably said three times already in this broadcast, the red zone issues.
Yeah, that's very true. All right, looking at the defensive side of things a little bit, Gerald McCoy continues to be Gerald McCoy, which is always an exciting thing and sometimes I think can get overlooked just because he is so consistently good at disruption. Overall defensive line pros and cons of what you saw this game, great to see Will Clark get in there and contribute a lot as well, but we're at the point at this point in the season, it's a pretty makeshift line at times because of how many injuries there have been. So how would you evaluate the way they were able to get some pressure?
You're right about Gerald McCoy, and he didn't have any sacks in this game, and he only, quotation marks if you're just listening to this, has five on the season, but he continues to be dominant. Remember that guest we had on our peer panel, the other Scott Smith?
Yes.
From Fox. Mm-hmm. He tweeted out a screenshot during the game of a snap, like right after the snap, and Gerald McCoy, the center has snapped the ball, and the quarterback's just starting to get it. Three of the offensive linemen and two of our defensive linemen haven't even moved yet, and McCoy is already in contact with the guy across the line of scrimmage. And I remember the play. He pushed his guy like 6 yards back in the backfield, but that guy had like help from two other guys, and Gerald's working really hard and spinning around, but he can't actually get there just because so much was devoted to him. And that underscores the same issue we've been saying for a while now, that Gerald's playing great, but and eating up blockers, but somebody has to take advantage of the one-on-ones that come out of that. And that's what happened on one of Will's sacks. Gerald sort of chased it, and Gerald sort of made it happen, and then Will took advantage.
That's true. And looking at the secondary, again, still missing Vernon Hargraves, how would you evaluate Ryan Smith? He'd had you know, pretty rough week the week before going against Julio Jones. Did you see him rebound a little bit
this week? It's the second time this year he had a rough week against Minnesota and rebound really well after that. And again, he'd been sort of doing this upward trajectory, tough game the previous week, but I thought he had the one play where he slipped and fortunately the ball was overthrown. But otherwise, I thought his coverage was real good. They tried to get him, they tried to hit Jordy Nelson deep in the second half, I think, and he was right on him.
Which is great to see, for sure. Okay, we still have one more segment coming up. That's getting to your Twitter questions. You can keep sending them in. Use that hashtag BucksLive. We're going to take a short break and we'll be right back.
I don't know nobody's going to let another man walk in their house and take something from them. So take that to heart. This is personal to me.
We call this the jungle, right? It's our house today, man. Let's be great, man. Let's go. Let's get it in, man.
Be legendary today. Yeah. Don't forget, this is our house. Yeah. This is our house. Yeah.
Takes the snap, looks to his right, look, crossing around, throw, caught ball, touchdown, Tampa Bay Buccaneers. Hit the backdrop. It's a Levante David quarterback sack, his second of the game.
Let's make it count. We're past the 50, okay?
Big Winston looking, James going to run to the left of the 10. He throws to the inside. Touchdown, Tampa Bay.
Attack, technique, and takeaway. Got it?
It's picked off. Intercept to the 30, to the 25, to the 20. Quan Alexander will take it to the house. Touchdown, Tampa Bay.
Welcome back to Buccaneers Insider Live, presented by Miller Lite. Casey Phillips and Scott Smith here. Time for our final segment, which is getting to your Twitter questions. You can continue to send them in throughout the segment. Use that hashtag BucksLive on Twitter so I can find it. All right, our first one comes from Fred. This is a question that I have always thought is interesting, and I don't know if you know the why of it, but he wants to know why there are only 46 players allowed to be available on game day versus the entire 53-man roster.
I do know the answer to this question.
Perfect, because I've actually been curious about this.
Okay. But it's going to be kind of a history lesson.
Oh, boy. Let's go. So is this almost as bad as the soapbox?
Yeah, this is more of a history lesson. Okay. So basically what 53 and 46 is a compromise. You got to go back to like the 50s and 60s. And if you look through as time went on, the rosters slowly expanded from whatever, I don't know the exact number, 35 or whatever. And then it was 40 and then it was 42 or whatever. But there was resistance to making the rosters too big because what the league didn't want was teams to fill their roster with a lot of specialized players. So if you can only have 42 players, but now you can have 45, maybe you're adding a guy that just returns kicks or just plays on just a gunner, or you have a kicker for kickoffs and a kicker for long-range field goals or whatever. They didn't want the game to get too specialized. And so as time went on and they wanted to increase the number of roster spots, that increasing roster spots, for one thing, is good for the players because you add 7 roster spots for 32 teams, you just created 210 more jobs, right? Or something like that. Mm-hmm. So the allowing you to have – it also allows you to weather injuries if you have 53 players instead of 46. So think of it this way. What the league really wanted – was 46-man rosters, but allowing you to have 53 allows you to weather injuries and give more jobs to players, but when it comes to game day, they still only have 46 to guard against that over-specialization. Now, there are plenty of people that would argue, forget about that, just let them play with all 53. Why are they on the team if you aren't going to use them? I'm explaining the reason why they set it up that way. Again, one other argument against that, allowing all 53 to play, would be if the 53 and 46 allows you to weather injuries because you've got seven more players, and when some guys – like last week in Green Bay, our entire seven-man inactive list was injured guys. Mm-hmm. If both teams had 53 players and it was that situation, and the Packers had, I think, one guy out. So we would have had seven guys that couldn't play, period, no matter if they wanted to or not, and would have had 46, and the Packers would have had 52. So we have that little bit of cushion there that allows the difference in injuries to measure out, and so both teams have this in almost every week. Both teams are going to have the same number of players available to them. It was a little bit different for us last week because with seven injured guys taking up the entire inactive list, we had all three quarterbacks up, and two of them weren't going to play.
Right.
So those two guys didn't play. We brought up Patrick O'Connor, defensive end. He probably would have been inactive for the game, but he was active, but he never got on the field, and neither did I think Mike Leakey. Mm-hmm. We just signed Lidke. I don't think he ever got on the field, and we had one more active offensive lineman than we would normally have. So, or actually, maybe not because Joe Holly got sick, but you get my point.
Right.
So that's why.
That's interesting. Okay. Cam wants to know why does it seem like the offensive unit is still struggling to get some of the bigger plays to, and he specifically says to our big name receivers.
Yeah.
I think it's still the DeSean Jackson deep ball question
why?
That we've gotten.
That's a good question. Don't forget, Mike Evans is actually a pretty decent down-the-field weapon as well. He's not necessarily the burner that DeSean is, obviously, but early in his career, we tended to be able to hit him a lot better down the field because he's really, really good at going up and catching contested passes. So I think we could have expected some bigger plays from him as well. And earlier in the year, the issue was just the quarterbacks, really. I mean, DeSean Jackson, throughout the year, the coaches have said he's doing everything right. He's running. We've seen it. We've seen it with our own eyes, opportunities for deep balls that we've missed. So I think the quarterbacks have missed on the deep balls a little more than you'd like. And then in a game like Green Bay, there just simply is too much pressure. I mean, when you have that sort of pressure all the time, it's hard to set up a long pass downfield. You're much better off throwing the screen passes, and they worked. But it's a combination of everything, really.
That's true. And I wanted to give DeSean a shout-out for last night. He paid for 50 Boys and Girls Club kids to get a $100 gift card to Walmart.
Whoa.
To, like, go shopping.
Did
with.
They do the spree right then, too?
Yeah, they got to do it right there. And he brought a bunch of his teammates with him, cool. Which was cool to see how respected he is that many guys would show up on
awesome.
Night off.
So the guys helped with the
they
kids?
They helped.
The
yeah, each guy had about four or five kids with him,
man.
And it was just madness. It was great. They were
I've
so
been
excited.
To some of those before. And it's funny to see, you'd expect, and they should, you'd expect the kids to go grab toys and stuff that they really want. But you also see kids, like, grabbing presents for their little sisters.
They do. They want them for everybody else. They specifically told them, no, this is for you.
Really?
You get what you want, because they did all
want
to get it for all their friends
That's
and family,
cute.
Which is really cool. So, okay, Simba wants to know, he says, 4-8 at this point is not what we wanted this year, but I've seen some bright spots, and he lists Justin Evans, Levante getting back to his old self, OJ. He says, what are some of the positives that you have seen this season that stick out the most to you?
Other than those, because those were good.
And if those are your answers, there you go.
Well, yeah, I mean, Levante's probably been our best week-to-week player, and it's so good to see him back to the way he should be. You know, he talked to me about how he had some things going on and some injuries last year that could have kept him from being peak Levante, but he's back. I do like the Justin Evans things. I didn't think when the season started necessarily he'd end up getting this much playing time throughout the year, and he has, and I think he's responded well.
Yeah, he's earned it.
Yeah. The tight end group as a whole. Think about the fact that Anthony Alclair had his first catch. I think those three guys are going to be a strength for us for a while, him and Cam Brayton and O.J. Howard. Jameis Winston probably because of the injury in the middle season didn't make as much of a progression as you were hoping in week three, but I still think you see enough there to think that next year will be another step forward for him. He's still going to have a lot of weapons around him. What else? You got any while I'm thinking?
Yeah, Justin Evans was going to be one for me, just his ball skills. That's something that you're not used to seeing even as much with a safety, I think, is his ability to make incredibly accurate or just acrobatic catches. That's the thing. All of his interceptions have been...
Well, this one in the last one sort of center field.
That one was a little bit easier. The two
like
before that
ones,
were incredible plays. And I remember them saying that was why they drafted him, was his ball skills. And they were worried a little bit about his foundations and his tackling a bit, that he is such a go-for-it type of safety.
Mm-hmm.
And really, we haven't seen him taking too many risks that he shouldn't have or missing too many huge plays. He's going to have a few rookie moments, but I think that compared to what those big plays have offered, he's come out on the right side.
The whole draft class has been very promising, and it reminds me of a name we haven't said.
Kendall Beckwith. As soon as you said that, I was like, that's what we should have said for sure.
Kendall's been great.
That's true. Okay, we have time for one more here. I think this is an interesting one. They want to know, what do you think is the most important part of any game at any given time?
Turnovers.
Okay. So you think the play that
but it's such an easy answer that you don't necessarily know all the time how to control. So I guess the other answer would be a line play. It all starts from the line. And when the Bucks have struggled this year, it's because on both sides of the ball, we're just not getting the play we need out of the line.
Okay, interesting. All right, that's going to do it for us here on Buccaneers Insider Live, presented by Miller Lite. Stay tuned to Buccaneers.com for all the coverage leading up to the Lions game on Sunday. We'll be out there 75 minutes before kickoff for another live show. You can continue to send us in your questions always throughout the week. Use that hashtag BucksLive, and we'll see you later.